Chapter 13. Trying to Cook the Books. Over the years, the CIA has resisted political pressures to change its judgments. When the military pushed for higher estimates of Soviet capability, the agency stuck to lower estimates that by and large proved to be correct. While Richard Helms bowed to White House pressure to see if foreign countries were financing dissident groups, he reported to Presidents Johnson and Nixon that there was no foreign involvement in the anti-war movement. When Nixon tried to enlist the CIA to cover up Watergate, Helms refused, resulting in his removal. The agency has protected the integrity of its personnel as well. In the summer of 1953, Senator Joseph McCarthy announced he had reason to believe there were more than 100 communists in the CIA. He aimed his sights at Cord Meyer, a CIA officer hired by Allen Dulles himself. Meyer had a liberal background. Before coming to the CIA, he had headed the United World Federalists, a group opposed to national armament. McCarthy got J. Edgar Hoover's FBI to investigate Meyer and came up with lurid charges. That he was, for example, an associate of Cass Canfield, who was described in an FBI report as sympathizing with communist causes. In fact, Canfield, then the chairman of Harper & Brothers, the New York publishing firm, was a moderate Democrat who had no interest in communism. Dulles opposed an FBI request to interrogate Meyer and said the CIA itself would investigate the charges. On Thanksgiving Day, Dulles called Meyer at home to say he had been cleared of any security problems. McCarthy also tried to railroad William P. Bundy, then assistant to the Deputy Director for Intelligence, but Dulles repulsed those efforts as well. In contrast, most government bureaucrats were afraid to stand up to McCarthy for fear they would be tainted as well. Probably the best example of CIA independence came during the Vietnam War. When President Johnson pushed the CIA to ratify his policies in pursuing the war, the agency did just the opposite. It warned that the domino theory, the claim that the rest of Southeast Asia would fall to communism if the North took over South Vietnam, was fallacious, thereby undercutting one of the administration's principal justifications for prosecuting the war. Repeatedly, the agency questioned the policymakers' continuing reassurances that progress was being made there. That is why the CIA was established in the first place, to provide candid, independent, and objective information and analysis about world events. If the agency lost that reputation, it would have nothing. But all that began to change when William J. Casey became DCI on January 28, 1981, or so it seemed. Casey was a brilliant man, a lawyer by training and a student by avocation. From 1944 to 1945, he was chief of the Special Intelligence Branch of the OSS in the European Theater of Operations. From 1971 to 1973, he was chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. In 1980, Ronald Reagan asked him to head his first presidential campaign. A voracious reader, Casey read every book he could get his hands on about world affairs and economics. He haunted Washington bookstores, especially Sidney Kramer Books, searching for the most obscure books he could find on Soviet issues and world affairs. Mostly it was to satisfy his intellectual curiosity. Casey bought so many books at a time that his security guards usually had to help him carry them all. One aide estimated he spent $40,000 a year on books and magazines alone. "He was the brightest person I've ever met," said Stanley Sporkin, who was Casey's general counsel at the CIA and is now a federal judge in Washington. "He had a photographic memory. He didn't tolerate fools. He couldn't stand long meetings. He would tell people, 'Don't repeat things, I understand,' and he did." But there was another side to Casey, that of the politician and policymaker, the dealmaker and ideologue. When he took the job of DCI, Casey asked President Reagan if he could have cabinet status, and Reagan agreed to give him that extra degree of prestige and clout. It was a critical break from the past, when directors of Central Intelligence were considered impartial purveyors of information. As a member of the cabinet, Casey became an integral part of the Reagan administration, responsible not only for running the CIA and presenting intelligence estimates to the president, but also for making policy. Casey was convinced that the Soviets were far more mendacious and powerful than the U.S. government collectively thought. In showing that the Soviet Union was an evil empire, He sought to outdo Ronald Reagan, to hit them where it hurt, to show them for what they were. Casey's approach to the CIA was shaped not only by his political conservatism, but also by his days in the OSS, known not only for its daring, but also for its cowboy-like ventures. While Casey was generally pleased with the work of the Directorate of Operations, he was not at all pleased with the work of the Directorate of Intelligence. To Casey, the analysts were a bunch of liberals, fuzzy-headed thinkers who did not know about the hard realities in the world and were afraid to venture opinions. Casey's first priority was to improve the estimating process, said John A. Bross, a longtime CIA operative whom Casey brought out from retirement to be one of his assistants. He found a very disorganized system. Estimates had gotten very thinned down. Bill's priority was to get the estimates back into a stronger posture and let people take stronger positions. Yet the direction Casey took was always in line with his conservative worldview. Soon he found himself colliding with the CIA's most hallowed commandment, "Thou shalt not cook the books." To goad the bureaucracy, Casey hired Herbert E. Meyer, a 36-year-old editor of Fortune whose book, War Against Progress, had been widely cited during Reagan's 1980 presidential campaign. The book was an attack on opponents of real estate and technological development. At first, Meyer, a cigar-smoking, smart, cocky man, was Casey's special assistant. In 1983, he got a much larger role as a vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council, the group of national intelligence officers who prepare the national intelligence estimates. In that job, Meyer helped manage production of all the CIA's estimates. At the same time, he continued to act as Casey's assistant. Meyer brought to the job both a conservative bent and a journalist's probing mind. He decided CIA analysts were too isolated from the rest of the world, too insular in their approach. Meyer had contacts abroad with politicians, statesmen, and chief executive officers of major corporations. While it was the job of the Directorate of Operations to obtain information in the field, it seemed to Meyer that the analysts should also have their own contacts and sources. "In New York, when I was at Fortune, you would walk around at lunch and pick up a book," Meyer would say. "The people at that agency have had lunch in the executive dining room for years. That is very destructive. You don't take an intelligence engine and put it out in the woods. It breeds ignorance, arrogance. If you are in the business of seeing trends, of seeing the future, government is not one of the places where one would be likely to work," he would say. "The rewards are much greater in journalism, politics, business, academia, and think tanks. The moment you start taking the C and maybe B students, they will hire other C and B students. Over time, you have an institution that is not operating the way it should. They want consensus rather than dissent. That isn't good enough in a fast-changing world." Thus, when Meyer suggested exploring a new issue that happened to support his conservative worldview, it was hard for anyone to accuse him of trying to distort the estimating process. His approach was to question, to probe, and to argue. Moreover, much as his views seemed out of place with prevailing thought, he sometimes was right. Whether Meyer actually changed analysts' lunch habits so they began seeing outsiders more, and whether that had any effect, is a matter that can be argued. But his feisty approach clearly produced fresh thinking. He, Meyer, brought a considerable freshness as an outsider to the organization, although he probably ruffled professional feathers because of his non-traditional approach and because many people did not like his political views, which are conservative. Graham E. Fuller, who was a national intelligence officer at the time and succeeded Meyer as a vice chairman, said, "But he did nothing but ask tough questions of people and engage them in debate. He did not dictate what our office would say. He would say, 'Have you considered this or that?'" A lot of people disagreed with Meyer, including me, Fuller said, "but I heard him out. I think he had some useful things to say. Because of his conservative background, a lot of people dismissed what he said." In much the same way, Casey would question and fulminate. Because he was the director, his views were taken much more seriously than Meyer's. But Casey soon learned that there was only so far he could go. He could not push the CIA officers into saying something they did not want to say or that they felt they could not support. But Casey tried, and the result was a series of spats, some public, some private, that created the appearance during Casey's tenure that the agency's analytical side was losing its integrity. It began on March 1, 1981, when the New York Times Magazine ran an excerpt of Claire Sterling's book The Terror Network, The Secret War of International Terrorism, which suggested that the Soviets were providing the weapons, training, and sanctuary for terrorists as part of the Soviet effort to undermine Western democracy. The CIA had never said anything like this. Casey wanted the agency's analysts to follow up and discover if Sterling's facts were right. The CIA director had long suspected that the Soviets were in control of world terrorism, using thugs from all over the world as fronts for their own devious purposes. What came out in the form of a draft estimate was ambiguous and not at all what Casey had wanted. According to those involved in preparing the estimate, the evidence available to the CIA at the time did not support Casey's or Claire Sterling's views. It was a question of semantics, said David D. Whipple, later National Intelligence Officer for Terrorism. He, Casey, would say, "They, the Soviets, support them, and therefore they are responsible. We would both go before a congressional committee." Casey would say, "They are responsible," and go back to work at noon and leave me to face the committee in the afternoon. I would try to erase what he said because I was trying to differentiate between Soviet support for so-called national liberation struggles and actual direction of terrorist activities. There was pressure internally to say more than we could professionally justify, and most of us resisted that, Whipple said. Casey was on the right. An NIO can't be as far forward-leaning as he was. Everything you say has to be supported by intelligence. You can't sit there and interpret facts. Casey had a way of going beyond that sometimes. Whipple said that despite more recent revelations of East Bloc support of terrorists, "I don't think they'll ever prove that the Soviets instigated actions of terrorism, but they certainly supported people and groups who did engage in terrorism." The analysts were afraid they would be accused of engaging in some political act, said Admiral Bobby R. Inman, who was Deputy Director of Central Intelligence at the time. The first draft bent over backward to avoid that. In any intelligence report, you identify assumptions. It said there is not conclusive evidence that this or that. I read it and put a note on it saying, "This sounds like the prosecutor's argument on why he decided not to prosecute the case." Casey was more blunt. He wrote on the draft, "This is a bunch of shit." According to Inman, Casey was concerned more with the lack of logic and flow than with the conclusion. I've seen other instances where he, Casey, had strongly different personal views, but the paper in those cases was very well written. He would say it was well composed or well done, Inman said. He then attached a memo on it to the president saying, "I don't agree with this," or "I think they are too bashful and my own view is this." He never took off his very conservative lenses about how he made his own valuation. But he was the most cautious DCI I've seen about not trying to change somebody else's words to shape a view. I think Casey sensitized, that's an understatement, the intelligence community to that possibility that the Soviets directed terrorists, Fuller said. The community was required to think more carefully about it. In the end, the community did not feel there was a sufficient case. In the end, he didn't fight the problem. Casey's intervention, his fervently conservative viewpoint, and his repeated involvement in the policies of the Reagan administration made him suspect in the eyes of CIA professionals, suspicions that sharpened after it turned out Casey had improperly and disastrously embroiled the agency's Directorate of Operations in the Iran-Contra affair. Another major flap came on September 28, 1984, when the Washington Post reported that John R. Horton, who had been National Intelligence Officer for Latin America, had resigned when Casey rewrote an estimate on Mexico to fit U.S. policy. According to the article, Horton had taken a moderate view about prospects in Mexico, and Casey wanted a hard-line approach that said the Mexican government would move to the left and become destabilized. The newspaper story made good copy, but the facts were quite different. The impetus for the estimate had come from Meyer and Casey when they began hearing anecdotes from friends in Mexico about worsening conditions there. For example, the owner of an executive search firm said everyone he knew was sending his kids to the U.S. Middle managers were said to be leaving the country. Brian Littell, a respected CIA analyst, was assigned to write a draft of the estimate. Usually, analysts base their conclusions on material available at headquarters, including traffic from stations. But Littell also traveled to Mexico, where Meyer kept in touch with him. Littell then wrote a draft of an estimate that concluded there was a possibility, later said at 1 in 5, that Mexico would become destabilized in the next 3 to 5 years. That view coincided with the concerns of Meyer and Casey, who felt U.S. policymakers should at least be alerted to the possibility that Mexico could become a serious problem. Meyer put a copy in his safe. Horton, a former station chief in Mexico City, disagreed with the draft. He exercised his right as the national intelligence officer in charge of the area to write a final version that disagreed with Littell's conclusions. Instead, he took a somewhat more sanguine view of developments in the country. But Meyer, as a vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council, exercised his right to change the estimate essentially back to Littell's draft. Horton's problem was we exercised our right to edit what he said, Meyer later said. He never said the draft he wrote was the second one. He turned the expert's draft around. We turned it back. He had a right. I also had a right. It was a fresh and provocative approach written by an analyst on Mexico which suggested a sharp recasting of our thoughts about Mexico, Fuller said. This analyst, who is immensely respected and knows the field, suggested this was not the only approach, but it deserved real consideration. Casey insisted that this aspect of analysis be given reasonable credence within the body of the overall estimate. Said Fuller, "If you say things will be the same, you'll probably be right 75% of the time. When credible analysts come up with fresh approaches, it behooves managers of intelligence to pay special attention." Casey ironically thought Horton was trying to suppress what the analyst had said. You had a bitter debate about it. But it was an honest estimate. It began on the first page of the finished estimate with virtually half the community dissenting from the pessimistic view, Robert Gates, who was then chairman of the National Intelligence Council, said. As events unfolded in Mexico, they turned out to fall somewhere in between Horton's approach and Littell and Meyer's, but the incident further strengthened the perception that Casey was cooking the books. The truth was, Casey did listen to facts and would back down if given a good argument. For the CIA's top officials, Casey's conservative bent was never any problem. They had enough standing to take him on. I felt when I went into Casey there was a first-class intellect at work who would listen and argue and respond, which was extremely gratifying to senior intelligence analysts, as opposed to people who are weak and not particularly seized with the substance of the thing, Fuller said. Yet no one can say for sure how much effect Casey's ideology might have had on lower-level analysts, any more than one can demonstrate the effect of a conservative or liberal newspaper publisher on the way his reporters cover the news. While Casey's constant questioning was stimulating, it all pointed in the same direction. Unlike his successor, William Webster, Casey was an observer with a political agenda. He was therefore at odds with the purposes of the CIA, to present the facts and just the facts as they are, rather than how policymakers may want them to be. While it turned out that Casey and Meyer were right on a number of issues, they also turned out to be wrong a number of times. In 1983, Meyer wrote a series of memos saying the Soviet economy was in a shambles, which proved to be far closer to the truth than what the CIA's estimates were saying. Casey handed the memos to Reagan. On the other hand, the same series suggested that the shootdown of a Korean Airlines passenger jet on September 1, 1983 was a dire Soviet plot. Meyer's memo predicted that there would be more such incidents. The majority report of the Congressional Iran-Contra committees later said Casey misrepresented or selectively used available intelligence to win support for the Nicaraguan Contras in certain limited areas. It said he pressured operations officers, as opposed to analysts in the Directorate of Intelligence, to change some reports on the Contras, overstated their supply problems in one high-level meeting, and wrote a letter to President Reagan that distorted the attitudes of Central American leaders toward the American Contra policy. Certainly, Casey's intervention created an appearance of lack of objectivity. In a business where integrity is critical, such an impression can be just as damaging as an outright effort to cook the books. Yet overall, the CIA continued to produce estimates that conflicted with Casey's views, demonstrating that ultimately he had little or no effect on the process. In 1983, the CIA said the rate of growth of Soviet defense spending was declining. The estimate conflicted with the agenda of the Reagan White House and Caspar Weinberger's Defense Department. Nor did Casey have any impact on the CIA's estimates on the prospects for the Nicaraguan Contra rebels, the Reagan administration's pet project. A June 1985 estimate on Nicaragua said, "The Sandinista military cannot by itself destroy the guerrillas, but neither can the insurgents destroy the Sandinista military." Not that Casey didn't try to alter that judgment. I argued with him, Casey, and others in this building, because for a number of years the argument of the intelligence community was that the Contras would not win the war in Nicaragua, said Richard J. Kerr, then the CIA's Deputy Director for Intelligence and later Deputy Director of Central Intelligence under Webster. They did not have the force, they did not have the confidence of the people, they did not have the capability to carry Nicaragua. He, Casey, did not believe that at all. But if you look at our product, it consistently said they would not win by force of arms. They weren't going to make a strong political movement. All they would do is cause the Sandinistas to modify their behavior. He didn't really agree with that, and he never came down and said, "You change that." Robert Gates, who was Deputy Director for Intelligence, Chairman of the National Intelligence Council, and Deputy Director for Central Intelligence under Casey, said Casey never influenced the analysts. The analytical side of the agency was always more pessimistic about the prospects for the Contras than the policy side of the government or the clandestine service, Gates said. At the same time, we were probably overly pessimistic about the Salvadoran military. The bottom line, Gates said, is that throughout that period, the agency did a lot of analytical work that was very unpopular with the policy side. The notion of analysis being influenced politically is dead wrong. He never told me to write something different than what I wrote, Kerr said. What he did do is say, "I don't believe this. I don't think this is what was reported. I don't think it's well documented. I don't think you've done a good analytic job on it, and I think you've missed what I consider to be the major issue." There are other people who say in that process he did that, bring political pressure to bear, because he was the boss and he could intimidate you. He tended to be more hard line, but not always. He had views, and they were strong views. They weren't necessarily always identical with conservative issues. If you were not willing to defend yourself, you could be rolled over by him, no question, Kerr said. But by and large, CIA remained impervious. It's not because we are better than other people, although we are good, but part of it is we believe there is no alternative to being impartial, Kerr said. That's what we do, and that's the only reason people read us. It's because they believe we have some contribution to make that is not tied to departmental policy. We may not understand it, we may be wrong, but it's not because we are pushing a line that is somebody's policy. If you vary from that, you lose your access, and you lose people who read you. For us, you are doomed if you do that. Ideally, Kerr said, you don't have a DCI like that, but you do need one who forces you to test things. He can have strong opinions. He needs to have different views to get people to develop their arguments. Nowhere was that better demonstrated than on the question of the Soviet economy. Chapter 14. Too Little, Too Late. Since the end of World War II, the CIA's Directorate of Intelligence has struggled with a close to impossible task, estimating the size of the Soviet economy and the amount of money spent on defense. It is difficult because of the nature of Soviet society. Until the end of the Cold War, the Soviet Union was closed to the outside world, but that was only part of the problem. The larger difficulty was that the economy of the Soviet Union defied all common sense. In theory, it was a planned, centralized economy where production, price, and quantity were dictated by Moscow. But in practice, because of this artificial control, it was larded with under-the-table transactions and fraud that were impossible to measure. From massive waste to black marketing, the Soviet economy operated on many levels. Under the planned economy, Soviets had no incentive to work hard or to produce anything. They got paid the same regardless of whether they did anything or not. Because prices of goods bore no relation to their actual cost or to their value to consumers, they did not serve the normal function of regulating supply and demand. In a free economy, if sneakers or chocolate are in short supply and in demand, their prices rise, spurring entrepreneurs to produce more of them. That was missing in the Soviet economy, where ponderous bureaucracies regulated supply. Even if it were possible to regulate millions of transactions from Moscow, the bureaucrats had no incentive to keep up with changes in demand. No matter how much chocolate or how many sneakers consumers wanted, the price and the supply remained the same. The Soviets themselves did not know the true size or shape of the Soviet economy. Much of the economic activity took place off the books, in bartering transactions that ate up a good chunk of each citizen's day. And the Soviets did not want to know about the huge amount of waste and fraud that consumed so much of the country's output. If the Soviets did not know, how was the CIA to know? The answers were critical. In order to better judge the strength of its adversary, the U.S. needed to know how much the Soviets were spending on defense and how long they could continue to do it. If the Soviet economy was strong, the Soviets could continue to pour massive amounts into defense indefinitely. If it was weak, the Soviets could be expected to cut down on defense spending. The two questions were interrelated. If the Soviet gross national product was higher than generally thought, the proportion it spent on defense was lower. If the GNP was lower, then defense spending was proportionately higher. In either case, the amount spent by the Soviets on defense was considered to be roughly the same amount spent by the U.S. For years, the CIA estimated that the Soviet economy was expanding by an average of 2.4% a year. Beginning in 1980, the CIA signaled that the Soviet economy was in trouble and losing momentum. It revised its estimate of annual growth slightly downward, suggesting it was averaging 2.1% a year. But the CIA's figures on the Soviet gross national product did not fully reflect how serious the problems were. According to CIA estimates, the Soviet per capita GNP was roughly half that of the U.S. Yet one did not need a Ph.D. in economics to see that that clearly could not be. Any visitor to the Soviet Union was shocked to find that, with the exception of its military, the USSR was a third-world country. Going into a grocery store was like walking into a tomb. On most days, they had literally nothing to sell except potatoes and onions. If they had some meat, it was almost entirely fat and invariably previously frozen. Chicken appeared to be a different species, virtually all skin and bones. Milk was sour when it was purchased. Often, milk sold as fresh was actually powdered. Apples were tiny and shriveled. The oranges were still green. Grapes, if available, were rotten. To meet plan quotas, tea was mixed with tiny branches and leaves of other plants to increase its bulk. Most third-world countries at least had enough to feed their people. To get an apple, one would have to try to wedge one's way into a crowd to get a peek at the prices. Then one would have to stand in line for a half an hour to get to the cashier to pay in advance for it. Finally, one waited in another line for another half hour to present the chit to a second clerk who weighed the apples and gave them to the customer without any bags or wrappings. Everything was made so cheaply and maintained so poorly that virtually nothing worked. A hotel such as the National across from Red Square in Moscow, supposedly high quality used by foreigners, confronted guests entering the lobby with a moldy smell and carpets that were threadbare and soiled. Standing at the reception desk was like going back to the 19th century. There was a wooden teletype machine that looked like one of the first radio sets. The guest rooms were out of the American West circa 1890. The furnishings were about what one would expect in an American prison, with two beds the size of cots that sank like pedestrian underpasses in the middle. They were covered with tattered spreads with holes in them. The sheets had small rust stains. The pine dresser was so battered it would not be sold at a rummage sale in the West. A table was covered with a cloth that looked as if it had been used for wrapping fish. But that was nothing compared with the bathroom. The tiles were coming off. Nothing was plumb. The toilet seat was as thin as the skin of a toy airplane. The sink was old and rusting. There was only one small piece of soap, and the toilet paper was coarser than the coarsest Western writing paper. The towels were so thin and worn from repeated washings they could barely absorb any moisture. Downstairs in the dining room there was at least one waiter for each table. Yet the service dragged on for hours because most of the time the waiters remained in the hallway chattering with each other. There was no incentive to do a good job or to cut down on extra workers because everything was owned by the government, which decided from Moscow how many waiters should work in each hotel, what prices should be charged, and how much food was needed. Souvenir shops had 3 saleswomen who helped each other ring up a sale. One would hand each item in turn to the cashier. The cashier rang up the sale, while the 3rd employee milled around and eventually wrapped the items. All 3 took more time to ring up a sale than the usual 1 American cashier. In the same vein, 5 or 6 taxicabs would pass by before 1 would pick up a passenger. The drivers got paid the same regardless of whether they picked up riders or not, so they continued driving without bothering to pick up anyone. After Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev took over in 1985, the already fragile Soviet economy began to crumble. His policy of perestroika, or restructuring, had the effect of destroying much of the existing system without replacing it with a new one. It was then that the CIA was blamed for failing to predict that the Soviet economy would collapse and for clinging to estimates of the Soviet gross national product that clearly did not portray how bad off it was. Yet for decades, the CIA's method worked. Because official statistics could not be trusted, the CIA developed a model of every facet of the Soviet economy, from the steel and transportation industries to production of coal and oil. Based wherever possible on visual evidence from satellites, the CIA determined the quantity and value of each item produced. For example, the CIA estimated the cost of producing a Soviet fighter plane by adding the value of the labor and the cost of the steel. Where satellite coverage would not work, the CIA used the observations of Soviet emigres or information obtained by intercepting Soviet communications. Then the CIA translated the findings into rubles and dollars. Since rubles could not be exchanged for dollars, the CIA had to estimate the conversion rate based on what each currency could buy. How many BTUs of coal, for example. The task was awesome. The CIA contracted out estimating the cost of reproducing each Soviet armament. As many as 50 CIA officers worked on the military questions alone. Every now and then they got a break, a Soviet book that listed shipbuilding costs, an overheard conversation about the size of the Soviet military budget, or a defector such as Nicholas Shadrin. Shadrin was a Soviet Navy commander who knew the costs of building destroyers. In 1975, a Soviet émigré who claimed to have seen the defense budget cited figures that tended to indicate Soviet military spending was higher than the CIA thought. Lieutenant General Daniel O. Graham, then director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, decided the CIA was ignoring him. Although the man had failed lie detector tests, Graham thought the CIA had botched the tests by making the man nervous. Graham interviewed the man himself and decided he was telling the truth. He said he wanted the CIA to polygraph him again, this time using questions he prepared. The man passed. The CIA's estimates of military spending doubled the next year, from 5 to 6% of the Soviet GNP to 11 to 12%. CIA officials said the émigrés' information played a role in the revision, which they claimed would have occurred anyway. In the early 1960s, William T. Lee, an analyst at the CIA, had devised a different estimating system that made use of Soviet statistics. It showed an even higher proportion of military spending. In 1964, Lee left the CIA over disagreements about his method. He later joined the DIA, but he continues to testify before Congress that the CIA's estimates, still based on methods developed when Lee was with the agency, are unrealistic. As of 1990, Lee was estimating Soviet defense spending at 25% of the Soviet GNP. "They, the CIA, wanted me to recant, and I left in disgust," Lee said. "I was saying that the method I was using is a better method than what they were using." The CIA said its method was superior because it was based wherever possible on what could be seen, rather than on Soviet statistics, which were notoriously fallacious and self-serving. Yet in the end, Lee's figures seemed to be closer to the truth than the CIA's. Igor Berman, a Soviet émigré and economist, also concluded early on that the Soviet economy was in much poorer shape than the CIA was claiming. According to Berman's figures, the Soviet GNP was only a third of U.S. GNP, more in line with that of a third-world country such as Mexico. In 1980, Berman described the Soviet economy in Soviet studies as being in a state of crisis. On October 27, 1980, Berman said in an op-ed page piece in the Washington Post that the CIA's estimates of the Soviet economy were far too rosy. Berman said the Soviet standard of living was only a fourth or even a fifth the American level. Berman said Soviet military spending is very likely about 20% of the Soviet GNP, a proportion then almost double the CIA's estimate. "I was alone in the world saying the huge CIA is wrong," Berman said. "The wonderful American press has criticized the CIA for spy operations, but never their analysis. I did. I knew I was alone, and if I say the truth, nobody would believe me." More recently, the CIA has said the Soviets spend 15% to 17% of their GNP on the military, compared with a figure of 25% cited by many of the critics. As the Soviet economy continued to deteriorate, Henry S. Rowan, a former chairman of the National Intelligence Council and later Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, and Andrew W. Marshall, Director of Net Assessments at the Defense Department, began sounding similar warnings. In 1986, they and Charles Wolfe, Jr., Dean of the Rand School of Graduate Studies, met with President Reagan to tell him the Soviet economy was in worse shape than the CIA was saying. "Your advisors have seriously underestimated the difficulties of the Soviet economy," Rowan told Reagan. "We are in a much stronger bargaining position." Their position coincided with memos William Casey had given to Reagan from Herb Meyer saying the Soviet economy was in much worse shape than the CIA was saying. Still, the CIA clung to its position. Indeed, that same year, the CIA said the Soviet economy was improving. Later, the agency took note of problems in the Soviet economy, but did not significantly revise its estimates of the GNP. For example, in 1987, the CIA said, "The Soviet economy has made solid gains since 1960, but its growth has slowed, especially in the last decade." In retrospect, the critics' characterization of the Soviet economy as a system in serious trouble has proven to be correct. Their estimates that Soviet military spending takes up a far greater chunk of Soviet output than the CIA thought are undoubtedly true as well. That individual economists, working with practically no funding, could come out closer to the truth than CIA analysts with their immense resources is cause for concern. At the same time, no one knows the true figures. How does one account for the fact that because the Soviet system measures output by square yards of glass produced, glass manufacturing plants make plate glass that is so thin that most of it breaks before it leaves the plant? Or that ornamental vases made of lead are produced in vast quantities, but no one buys them? They are therefore stacked in a yard and melted down to go into the next year's supply of unwanted vases. Trainloads of new tractors are delivered in a cannibalized state because people cannot obtain spare parts. People therefore steal the wheels and transmissions right off the tractors after they leave the factory. Likewise, up to a third of the Soviet wheat harvest has been estimated to consist of rubbish, weeds, and moisture. At the same time, because of poor transportation and storage facilities, as much as half of Soviet farm production never gets to market. Gorbachev himself estimated in June 1985 that a fifth of the overall agricultural harvest was being lost. According to Swedish economist Anders Östlund, if Soviet manufactured goods were sold in the West, the prices they would fetch would be lower than the prices of the raw products used to manufacture them. "It is a startling experience to walk into Soviet stores, assess the Western value of Soviet-made commodities, and compare them with actual Soviet prices," Östlund has written. "In the vast majority of cases, the Western market value of a Soviet commodity, food as well as industrial goods, would be nil or close to nil, since their quality is so poor that they could not be sold in the West." Meanwhile, a large chunk of consumer needs is met on the black market, still another quagmire that is impossible for economists, in or out of the country, to measure accurately. "We try to account for fraudulent production like glass that breaks," a CIA analyst involved in producing the agency's Soviet figures said. "Sometimes we succeed, sometimes we fail." By April 1990, John L. Helgerson, the CIA's deputy director for intelligence, was finally venturing that the Soviet economy was in an unstable state and could be pushed over the edge into sharp deterioration by further strikes or ethnic unrest. Still, The most likely outcome for 1990 is that the Soviet economy will stagnate or decline slightly, the CIA said. It was too little too late. By then, the CIA had clearly blown it. With some exaggeration, William Safire wrote in the New York Times, "The central mission of U.S. intelligence is to gather and evaluate data on the economic and military strength of the Soviet Union in comparison with the U.S. We are now discovering how the CIA has botched that assignment." Even Abram Bergson, the Harvard economist who helped develop the model used by the CIA while working for the Rand Corporation, has said recently, "I think the GNP is overstated by the CIA. How much is controversial?" But given the difficulty of the job, the CIA over the years had done remarkably well. Predicting even the American economy correctly is a daunting task. For every five economists, as the aphorism goes, there are six opinions. In the early days of the Cold War, the CIA gave U.S. policymakers a rough indication of the strength of the Soviet economy and the amount being spent on armaments. Contrary to Safire's comment, the agency accurately cataloged the size and shape of the Soviet military. This was far more important than predicting the proportion of the Soviet economy spent on defense. It was only when the Soviet economy began to disintegrate that the CIA moved too slowly to recognize the change. Whether through the CIA, Herb Meyer's memos from Casey, or his meeting with the critics in 1986, the word got through to President Reagan. In his book An American Life, Reagan wrote, "As president, I learned the Soviet economy was in even worse shape than I'd realized. It was a basket case, partly because of massive spending on armaments." Did they get the numbers wrong? Yes. Did they underestimate the percentage of Soviet GNP going to defense? I'd bet my life on it, Robert Gates, who oversaw the CIA's estimates as Deputy Director for Intelligence, said when he was President Bush's Deputy Assistant for National Security Affairs. But did they generally portray a Soviet economy in trouble and one less and less able to support this superstructure of the military and intelligence? I think they did. As the stories about the CIA's tardy response to the changes in the Soviet economy faded from memory, the CIA's intelligence directorate was faced with a new and much more critical challenge, predicting what Iraq was doing as it moved troops toward Kuwait. Chapter 15. Triumph. As the Cold War ended and the Soviet Union became less of a threat, the press began to question the need for a CIA. But those who raised the issue had only a limited perception of what the CIA does. By spying on friendly countries, the agency prepares for threats that may develop when those countries turn hostile. There could be no better example than Iraq's invasion of Kuwait on August 1, 1990. During Iraq's 10-year war with Iran, the United States had tilted toward Iraq as the lesser of two evils. The Reagan administration approved giving Iraq the data from satellite reconnaissance to help it fight Iran, along with U.S. agricultural credit guarantees and Export-Import Bank financing. When the war ended, Iraq had $80 billion in debts and dwindling oil income. As his money problems worsened, Saddam Hussein, the Iraqi president, became belligerent toward the West. By February 1990, Hussein was calling for the U.S. fleet, which had been in the Persian Gulf for 40 years, to return to the United States. On March 15th, over British protests, Iraq executed Farzad Bazoft, an Iranian-born journalist working for the British press, for spying. On April 1st, Saddam Hussein threatened to make the fire to eat up half of Israel. On April 12th, he told five U.S. senators that an all-out campaign is being waged against us in America and in the countries of Europe. At the end of May, he charged that Kuwait was waging economic warfare against him. He complained that Kuwait would not agree to lower oil production in order to raise oil prices, increases that Iraq needed to pay off its mounting debts. Analysts at the Directorate of Intelligence watched these developments with keen interest. During Iraq's war with Iran, the CIA had built up an extensive database on Iraq and its military and industry, including its chemical and biological weapons plants. The CIA also knew what kinds of movements the Iraqi military made before taking offensive action. However, in part because the CIA had been ordered to help Iraq during the war, The Directorate of Operations had not had much interest in developing an extensive array of agents or human spies within the government. Moreover, since Saddam Hussein trusted only close friends and family members, it would have been extremely difficult to do so under any circumstances. In November 1989, the CIA prepared a national intelligence estimate that said Saddam Hussein wanted to be the bully of the Middle East. Going with what a reasonable man would think, the estimate said it would take 3 years before he had recovered enough from the war with Iran to take any action. In 1990, an analyst wrote a think piece suggesting that the Iraqi leader might invade islands coveted by Iraq off the Kuwaiti coast, and that he might go on to invade Kuwait itself. 3 weeks before Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, the CIA's Directorate of Science and Technology began receiving hard evidence of a military buildup near the Kuwaiti border. The question was whether Iraq meant to invade Kuwait or merely to threaten it. The State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research thought Saddam Hussein was probably bluffing. But as days wore on, the CIA began warning the president that Iraq would most likely invade. Strong words could threaten them, the Kuwaitis, let alone 100,000 troops, Richard J. Kerr, the CIA's Deputy Director for Central Intelligence, said. It was clear there was more there than was needed to bluster, and there was a serious military operation, and given the forces, there was an increasing possibility, and probability as we walked down to the last several days, that he would actually move at least partway into Kuwait, Kerr said. There was a probability he would take the northern areas and the oil fields and islands, and a possibility he would go much farther and take the whole thing. On August 1st, the CIA said it was more likely than not that Iraq would invade within 24 hours. By predicting the invasion, the CIA had given President Bush and his policymakers additional time to plan a response, which came almost immediately in the form of a demand that Iraq pull out of Kuwait. Whether the early information could have been used or should have been used as the basis for a stronger warning to Iraq before the invasion is debatable. In now famous remarks, April Glaspie, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, told Saddam Hussein on July 25th that the United States had no opinion on Iraq's border dispute with Kuwait. But she also warned, according to her later statement before Congress, that the United States would protect its vital interests in the area. Glaspie's cables reporting on her meeting with Saddam Hussein did not support her testimony to Congress that she warned the Iraqi president that the U.S. would protect its interests in the area. However, a cable from President Bush to Saddam Hussein after the meeting said, "We believe that differences are best resolved by peaceful means and not by threats involving military force or conflict." Bush could have warned Iraq more bluntly that any invasion would be turned back by force. But the U.S. would have had to be in a position to back up any threat with action, and the administration was not yet ready to take that position. Indeed, Saddam Hussein asked Glaspie to assure Bush that he had no intention of attacking Kuwait. That reassurance was soon amplified by King Hussein of Jordan, President Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, and King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, who each told Bush that in their view the Iraqi president would not attack. Nevertheless, at 3 p.m. on August 1st, Assistant Secretary of State John Kelly warned Iraq that its differences with Kuwait must be resolved peacefully. He asked Iraq to pull its forces back. Iraq denied any aggressive intentions. By 8 p.m., the invasion had begun. If you go back through the meetings at the NSC, National Security Council, at the deputy level, you'll see a realistic assessment of Saddam Hussein in terms of a man who was pretty much a cutthroat bully, Kerr said. The question was, how do you deal with him? Do you deal with him by threatening him, or do you try to engage him in some kind of a process? Threatening him without backing it up is not useful. Just saying, you better not do it, is not going to have much impact. Ideally, the Bush administration would have threatened Saddam Hussein with force if he moved into Kuwait. But whether that would have worked is highly debatable. Over the ensuing months, Saddam Hussein refused to budge even when threatened with massive military force by the U.S. and its allies. In the end, only military action against Iraq's forces worked. The CIA collected most of the intelligence used. First, the CIA reassigned at least 4 photo reconnaissance satellites to orbit over the Middle East. Costing $1 billion to $1.5 billion apiece, The satellites were from the KH-11 and KH-12 series. They orbited 200 to 500 miles above the Earth's surface. In addition to relaying photographic images in real time, the satellites transmitted images based on heat emissions. La Crosse, a satellite system using radar imaging, saw through cloud cover, darkness, and smoke from 500 miles above the Earth. Finally, satellites codenamed Magnum and Vortex intercepted Iraqi communications from 22,000 miles above the Earth. The Directorate of Operations formed a wartime task force of more than 200 officers. Among other things, they worked to free Americans held by Iraq during the early stages of the conflict, established a clandestine radio station that urged Iraqi troops to surrender, and helped the U.S. Army design leaflets urging surrender. Through the National Collection Division within the Directorate of Operations, the CIA was able to obtain the plans for weapons plants and other military installations from American businessmen. The Soviet East Europe Division obtained similar information from Poland and Hungary, countries that had formerly worked with the Soviets to supply Iraq its armaments. Meanwhile, the CIA's Counterterrorism Center sifted through more than 100 terrorist threats that came in against the countries allied against Iraq just after the invasion of Kuwait. After war broke out, the CIA recorded 120 terrorist acts, not threats, against the Allies. Working with law enforcement agencies throughout the world, the CIA helped to foil a number of the efforts. The Directorate of Intelligence established a task force of 100 analysts who pored over the images, intercepts, and reports from agents. Before the war began on January 16, 1991, they issued some 500 reports to the White House on the effect of economic sanctions against Iraq and on Saddam Hussein's preparations for war. After Desert Storm began, the CIA issued hundreds of additional reports to the White House and the military. Among them were analyses of Saddam Hussein, who was judged to be sane and operating according to the values and traditions of his society. Dr. Gerald M. Post, a former CIA psychiatrist who analyzed personalities of world leaders, described Saddam Hussein as a man who is not suffering from a psychotic disorder. He is not impulsive, acts only after judicious consideration, and can be extremely patient, indeed uses time as a weapon. While he is psychologically in touch with reality, he is often politically out of touch. Saddam's advisors do not lightly contradict his views or his plans. According to Dr. Post, the Iraqi leader is able to justify extremes of aggression on the basis of revolutionary needs. If the aggression is counterproductive, he has always shown a pattern of reversing his course when he has miscalculated, waiting until a later day to achieve his revolutionary destiny. Dr. Post later expanded his evaluation of the Iraqi leader, saying he suffers from malignant narcissism, a severe personality disorder that manifests itself in paranoia, ruthlessness, and grandiose ideas. The CIA presented most of its key findings to President Bush at daily 8 a.m. briefings, when the agency gave him the President's Daily Brief, PDB, a compendium of the CIA's best intelligence and analysis. From the day the CIA began, the agency had prepared a daily current intelligence summary, which evolved into the National Intelligence Daily, now given to 250 senior government officials in Washington and hundreds of other U.S. officials around the world. However, President Kennedy asked for a publication that would more directly address his needs and interests. The result was the PDB. Each president designates who should receive the PDB within his administration. Bush wanted it distributed only to the Secretaries of Defense and State and to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The PDB also goes to other members of the intelligence community besides the CIA. Some presidents, such as Ronald Reagan, did not read the PDB themselves, preferring to have their national security advisors read the document and brief them. Others, such as George Bush and Gerald Ford, read the PDB themselves. When they are reading it, they receive a briefing from a CIA analyst. The briefer jots down questions the president has as he reads the PDB and listens to the briefing. The briefer brings back answers the next morning or sooner if necessary. The PDB is prepared by the CIA's Office of Current Production and Analytics Support. Located on the 7th floor of the old CIA headquarters building, it is part of the Directorate of Intelligence and includes the CIA's Operations Center that keeps track of minute-to-minute developments around the world. The center looks very much like the news anchor studio of a major television network. Like many CIA offices, the windows are protected with devices that vibrate, making it impossible for laser beams from outside to pick up sound from within. Like the offices of most high-ranking CIA officials, it has a television monitor tuned constantly to cable news network, CNN. The PDB is prepared by 10 officers, including a chief and deputy chief who also take turns briefing the president each morning. The officer who will brief the president the next day usually stays until 8 p.m. the night before to read a draft of the next day's PDB. He comes back to the CIA before the PDB's 5:30 a.m. deadline to insert any late-breaking developments. The CIA's printing plant at the northwest end of the CIA compound then prints the top-secret document. The Director of Central Intelligence receives a draft of the PDB at the end of the day so he can read it on the way home. A final copy is delivered when the CIA security guards pick him up in the morning. The PDB is usually 8 to 10 letter-sized pages arranged in newspaper column format. The pages on the left are usually reserved for photographs, charts, and tables. Like a newspaper, the PDB presents the most important news near the front, while longer analyses appear near the end. For example, before the war began, the PDB carried an analysis of Saddam Hussein's personality. The PDB staff refers to it as the book. As a rule, about half of what are known as key facts in the PDB are not yet publicly known. For example, during the war, the PDB addressed the question of whether Israel would respond to Iraq's Scud missile attacks. Other material, while rumored, was reported with more authority than what appeared in the press at the time. The PDB also conveyed analysis. For example, it summarized William Webster's prediction in December 1990 that Saddam Hussein would not withdraw until faced with imminent military attack. In January 1991, Webster said that economic sanctions alone would not force Saddam Hussein to withdraw his forces from Kuwait for at least a year. The agency thus dismissed the possibility that economic sanctions would work in the foreseeable future, a judgment proven correct by later events. The PDB also correctly predicted that Saddam Hussein would use scorched earth tactics and spill oil on the Persian Gulf before withdrawing from Kuwait. When William Webster was DCI, he briefed the president himself, along with the officer from the PDB, 3 to 4 times a week. During the war, he briefed him virtually daily. First, Webster met with Bush's national security advisors and gave them a copy of the PDB. Then, for the next 15 to 20 minutes, they all met with Bush to review it and take questions. The briefer then returned the document to the CIA. If Bush was out of town, he received a copy of the PDB by secure fax. What has been unique in the Bush administration, and was done only once before with Gerald Ford, is that we have daily personal contact with the president when he is in town, a member of the PDB staff said. The normal pattern has been for the person we call the PDB briefer to go downtown and see the National Security Advisor and sit with him while he goes through the book and asks questions, hand over any supplemental material, late-breaking news, and photography that illustrates the point and that came in too late to get in the book. The National Security Advisor would then see the president. Both Ford and Bush had read the PDB when they were vice president and had come to rely on it. As a former CIA director and someone who was intimately familiar with the foreign policy issues addressed, Bush took a particular interest in the briefing. Bush, after he was elected, I think the first day, said he would like to continue to have someone from CIA brief him, the staffer said. He reads it, and the others read it at the same time. The president asks questions. How confident are we of this particular information? Might we be able to get additional information on this using one or another kind of collection technique? Then usually the briefer leaves, and usually the director leaves. Occasionally he'll stay behind to discuss a sensitive program, or the president will ask him something. In reporting on Iraq, the CIA's efforts were not without flaws. The agency vastly overestimated the number of Iraqi soldiers in Kuwait. Many had defected from their units, and the agency assumed each unit in place had a full complement of men. The CIA underestimated the number of Iraqi mobile Scud launchers. and the agency did not know that the bunker in the Amariya district in Baghdad, used as a secret military command post during the day, was packed with hundreds of women and children at night. The reason was that most of the spy satellites passed over Iraq during the day. Many women and children died when an American jet attacked the bunker. But overall, the performance of the CIA and related intelligence agencies was a triumph, as the Wall Street Journal later called it in a feature article by Walter S. Mossberg. The military was able to see its targets from space in real time, a war-winning advantage. With few exceptions, the CIA pinpointed every tank, every gun emplacement, and every chemical and biological weapons facility. When a defector reported that, contrary to earlier reports, not all of Iraq's equipment for making nuclear explosives had been destroyed, the CIA provided photographs of out-of-date uranium enrichment machinery being moved around on trucks or being buried to evade United Nations inspections. Most important, the CIA had predicted the outbreak of the war in the first place. The Central Intelligence Agency and its sister services, especially the code-breaking National Security Agency, supplied U.S. military commanders with an immense quantity of timely information, the Wall Street Journal said. Spy satellite photos, intercepted Iraqi military communications, and other data gave U.S. generals a capability their predecessors could only dream about, the ability to track just about every important military action Iraq undertook. A later story by George Lardner, Jr. of the Washington Post sounded a similar theme. U.S. intelligence during the Persian Gulf War has been widely rated by government officials as superb in many respects, but the conflict also produced hard evidence of the breakdowns that can occur, the July 5, 1991 story said. While Army General H. Norman Schwarzkopf later complained that analyses were too qualified, he said intelligence during the war was excellent, contributing to the Allied success. He also singled out for criticism bomb damage assessments, which conflicted with higher reports of damage from pilots. Which assessments were closest to the truth is still not clear. Like any witnesses, pilots are often wrong. On the other hand, the analysts back in Washington had little experience tracking the kind of destruction wreaked by smart weapons. From the air, a tank may appear undamaged because it has not exploded in flames and appears to have only a tiny hole where a missile entered it. But today's missiles can wipe out the inside of a tank and its occupants without creating outside damage. For that reason, the analysts could very well have underestimated damage, contributing to unnecessary loss of lives from bombing missions that were not militarily necessary. But that kind of analysis, for the most part, was done by military intelligence analysts, not by the CIA. Some publications trumpeted what they called failures of intelligence during the war. They cited the fact that the CIA had overestimated the number of Iraqi soldiers in Kuwait and had predicted that Saddam Hussein would use chemical weapons. Yet overestimates of opposing forces can never be a failure if the idea is to win the war. Where it overestimated the enemy, the CIA contributed to the Allied success by suggesting the need for a large military offensive able to swiftly overrun the enemy. If you know others and know yourself, you will not be imperiled in 100 battles, the Chinese warrior philosopher Sun Tzu said more than 2,000 years ago. The fact is that Saddam Hussein, who should have known more about his own forces than did the CIA, also overstated their capabilities and did not take desertions into account. To expect that anyone can predict every tactic that an enemy will use, including use of chemical weapons, is unrealistic. Some media critics and a few members of Congress said the CIA should have known earlier on that Saddam Hussein would invade Kuwait. The president could have had very many options if the plans to invade Kuwait were known weeks earlier, Senator David L. Boren, the Oklahoma Democrat who headed the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, said. Only in the last few days before the invasion did U.S. intelligence agencies forecast its occurrence, Boren said. Again, the criticism was unfounded. If there were evidence that Saddam Hussein knew what his own plans were well before the CIA knew about them, the criticism might have been justified. Certainly his officers did not know his plans. In interviewing captured Iraqi officers, the CIA found that the military did not know more than 24 hours before the invasion what their leader's intentions were. Tariq Aziz, Iraq's foreign minister during the war, told Milton Viorst, on assignment for The New Yorker, that Saddam Hussein did not decide to invade Kuwait until August 1st, when talks on oil disputes between Iraq and Kuwait collapsed in Jeddah. In effect, the critics were saying that the agency should have known that Saddam Hussein was going to invade Kuwait before he knew it. To suggest that the CIA should have known more than the enemy knew is to require clairvoyance, something that no one has yet been able to achieve. Intelligence is nothing more than information, and to insist that the CIA should have it before it exists is unfair. Unless there is reason to believe that an event is going to happen, the CIA has no business saying it might happen. After all, anything might happen. 3 weeks before the military offensive took place, the CIA raised the possibility that Iraq would invade. In doing so, the CIA fulfilled its role, which is to take the first cut at world events, to filter out important developments, to bring them to the attention of the White House, and to sound a warning about the possible outcomes so that policymakers can prepare. Absent hard evidence, the CIA would have been irresponsible if it had said flatly that Saddam Hussein would invade. Even if the CIA had had hard evidence of Saddam Hussein's intentions early on, no one, including the Iraqi leader, knew for sure that he would go ahead with the plan until he did. The fact is, the CIA did raise the possibility that Iraq would invade Kuwait 3 weeks before the invasion. It could not have stated the case more strongly than it did, because even to this day there is no evidence that Saddam Hussein knew then he would order an invasion. Even when the CIA did sound the alarm, the Bush administration did very little about it. "People make critical comments about us all the time," Kerr observed. "A lot of it is out of frustration. We don't do what they would like us to do, or we are doing something they would just assume we didn't do." The fact is, the U.S. could not have won the war with its outflanking maneuvers and precise bombing as quickly and effectively as it did if it had not had good intelligence. In this case, the intelligence overall was nothing short of spectacular. Yet even when the CIA does well, its success is often portrayed as failure. Meanwhile, an entire directorate of the CIA goes on about its business, largely unaffected by the crisis of the moment. This is the Directorate of Administration, which supports the CIA. Yet in many ways, this is the most fascinating of all the CIA's directorates. Because it contains the Office of Security, it is also the one with the most problems.